I've been enjoying professing poetry. I took the post on nervously, really, because I don't normally give lectures, and I've been withdrawing from the poetry reading scene. But it's really been wonderful. I feel a more confident and fulfilled human being as a result of the post and the last 2 years. I'm ending my time at Trinity shortly, and last year, as Katrina was saying, I was at Queen's, and next year I'll be here. Talking with young people, with students about their work has been a deep experience. I think I believe that the young are always right, even when they're wrong. And I feel, in the true sense of the Latinate word, rejuvenated. Now, I thought I would read, in the course of the evening, seven or eight new poems, and then a selection from 40 years. And I find, you know, that extraordinary, that nice French word, oeuvre. My oeuvre is even more than 40 years old. So, and then I thought I would begin with a group, a little cluster of love poems, because love poetry seems to me a central part of the enterprise. And I go right the way back to my 20s with the first, which is called Swan's Mating. And then a poem I don't often read, but which I've rediscovered, called The Rope Makers, which is about domesticity, domestic love, if you like. And I'll follow that with a poem called An Amish Rug. And then I'll introduce the last two, okay. So it's time, after all this chat, to read a poem. Swan's Mating. Even now, I wish that you had been there, sitting beside me on the riverbank, the cob and his pen sailing in rhythm until their small heads met and the final heraldic moment dissolved in ripples. This was a marriage and a baptism, a holding of breath, nearly a drowning. Wings spread wide for balance where he trod, her feathers full of water, and her neck under the water like a bar of light. And the next one, The Rope Makers, is all in one sentence. A grammatical echo of its theme, The Rope Makers. Sometimes you and I are like rope makers, twisting straw into a golden cable. So gradual, my walking backwards, you fail to notice when I reach the door. Each step infinitesimal, a delay, neither a coming nor a going when, across the laneway I face you still, or at large at last in the sunny fields, struggle to pick you out of the darkness, where, close to the dresser, the scrubbed table, fingers securing the other end, you watch me diminish in a square of light. An Amish Rug. As if a one-room schoolhouse were all we knew, and our clothes were black, our underclothes black, marriage, a horse and a buggy going to church, and the children silhouettes in a snowy field. I bring you this patchwork like a small holding where I served as the hired boy behind the harrow. His threads the colour of cantaloupe and cherry, securing hay bales, corn cobs, tobacco leaves. You may hang it on the wall, a cathedral window, or lay it out on the floor beside our bed, so that whenever we undress for sleep or love, we shall step over it as over a flower bed. And a few years ago, on our 36th anniversary, better get it right, I discovered in the loft the fat envelope which contained the Vogue pattern for my wife's wedding dress. We were married on an extremely windy day, and the day when I discovered the pattern, there had been a fall of snow, beautiful, dry, crisp snow, and it all came together in this poem called The Pattern. 36 years to the day after our wedding, when a cold, figure-revealing wind blew against you and lifted your veil, I find in its fat envelope the 6-shilling Vogue pattern for your bride's dress, complicated instructions for stitching bodice and skirt, box pleats and hems, tissue paper outlines, semblances of skin which I nervously unfold and hold up in snow light, for snow has been falling on this windless day, and I glimpse your wedding dress and white shoes outside in the transformed garden, where the clothesline and every twig have been covered. And a new one. Still writing love poems at my age. This is about cloudberries, which grow, as you know, in the tundra. And they're labor intensive, and there are disputes about whose right it is to pick them because they're a precious crop. Cloudberries. You give me cloudberry jam from Lapland, bog amber, snowline titbits, scrumptious cloudberries sweetened slowly by the cold, and costly enough for cloudberry wars, diplomatic wars, my dear. Imagine us among the harvesters, keeping our distance in sphagnum fields on the longest day, when dawn and dusk, like frustrated lovers, can kiss, legend has it, once a year. Ah, kisses at our age. Cloudberry kisses. And I do love the western seaboard of this island. And I'm going to go on to read a little cluster of poems about the West. In fact, I'll let you into a secret. My third lecture, which I'll be giving here, I'm just going to call it The West. Now, when I was a cub at Trinity, the friendships there with people like Kennelly and Mahan and so forth were terribly intense. And there was no interchange between us and our counterparts in UCD. UCD was like an alternative universe, really. We glimpsed UCD students once a year in the varsity match as the enemy. But I want to remember one son of UCD who died 10 years ago, Michael Hartnett. And it's my regret, really, that my chums and I didn't get to know the poets of UCD, our contemporaries, although we've all got together since. And Hartnett died, as I say, 10 years ago, and I do admire his poetry. So this is a little elegy for him, and remembering him in this place at this time. An October sun in memory of Michael Hartnett. Something inconsolable in you looks me in the eye. An October sun flashing off the rainy camber. And something ironical too, as though we could warm our hands at turf stacks along the road. Good poems are as comfortlessly constructed, each sod handled how many times. Michael, your poems endure the downpour like the skylark's chilly hallelujah, the robin's autumn song. When I first discovered County Mayo, and especially the little townland of Carrigskeewaun, I was obsessed by the wildflowers and the wild birds. And it took me a while, really, to get to know the people. I'm not that sociable anyway, but there was one wonderful farmer called Joe O'Toole, and he mattered a great deal to me. And he was very proficient magician at fixing my sequence of very temperamental Ford Escorts that used to seize up in the dampness of that place. And this is a poem in which I invoke a badger, which unfortunately he and I drove over. It's not funny at all. We were nearly in tears. We got out of the car to mourn it, you know. And then an otter, which I encountered on top of the burial mound. And between hovers in memory of Joe O'Toole. And not even when he ran over the badger did he tell me he had cancer, Joe O'Toole, who was psychic about carburetor and clutch and knew a folk cure for the starter engine. Backing into the dark, we floodlit each hair like a filament of light our lights had put out somewhere between Kinadui and Talabon. I dragged it by two gritty paws into the ditch. Joe spotted a ruby where the canines touched. His way of seeing me safely across the dirt was to leave his porch light burning, its sparkle shifting from widgeon to teal on Corrigan Lake. I missed his funeral. Close to the stony roads, he lies in Killeen churchyard over the hill. This morning, on the burial mound at Temple Du Mor, encircled by a spring tide and taking in Clunamanna and Clagan and Carrigskeewaun, the townlands he'd wandered tending cows and sheep, I watched a dying otter gaze right through me at the islands in Clew Bay, as though it were only between hovers and not too far from the Holt. And the hovers, that beautiful word for the temporary stopping off place of an otter. And we stay, and we've been staying for about 45 years now in a cottage owned by the great ornithologist David Cabot. And he bought the cottage off the O'Toole family, and no relation to Joe O'Toole. But it was Joe O'Toole who told me about the people. And they'd come in the 20s from Inishdaigle, which is an island in Killary, because the state could no longer secure their well-being. And I can't imagine what it was like. And Mrs. O'Toole had 11 children on the island without a doctor or a midwife. And when she came to Carrigskeewaun, which we think of as wild, it was the height of civilization for her. And she said, "I can now walk anywhere." And the O'Toole house, the 13 of them, were all proficient musicians, and they sang. They spoke Irish and English. They sang songs and told stories and played instruments. And the cottage where we stay was then a famous Cayley house, and people travelled all the way from Connemara across the Killary in their curraghs, and then another half-hour walk across rough territory just for a good night. And the river, our local river, is the Owen Adirnon. Cayley. A Cayley at Carrigskeewaun would now include the ghost of Joe O'Toole at ease on his hummock, the far side of Corrigan Lake, as he listens to the O'Tooles from Inishdaigle, who settled here 80 years ago. 13 O'Tooles, each of them a singer or fiddler, 13 under the one roof, a happy family, but an unlucky one, Joe says. And the visitors from Connemara, who have rowed their curraghs across the Killary for the music. And my ghost at the Duick's sheep-bitten edge, keeping an eye on the lamps in the windows here, but distracted by the nervy plover that pretends a broken wing, by the long-lived oyster catcher that calls out behind me from Tullabon Strand. The 13 O'Tooles are singing about everything. Their salty eggs are cherished for miles around. There's a hazel copse near the lake without a name. Dog violets, sorrel, wood spurge are growing there. On Inishdaigle, there's a well of the purest water. Is that Arcturus or a faraway outhouse light? The crescent moon's a coracle for Venus. Look, through the tide and over the Owen Adirnon are shouldered the coffins of the 13 O'Tooles. And a new one. I'm sure some of you know the magical metropolis of Lewisburg. Now, the heart of Lewisburg for me was, and in a way remains, Charlie Gaffney's pub. And Charlie was one of the subtlest, most interesting men I've ever met. Quiet. I've always thought that if he hadn't been a publican, he'd have been a professor of philosophy. And you remember in the charity box clusters, there used to be something for the lifeboats, and you put an old penny in and you launched the lifeboat. If you don't remember that, this poem's lost on you, I'm afraid. So, it's as well I'm here. Anyway, like Joe O'Toole, I really loved Charlie. the lifeboat. I have imagined an ideal death in Charlie Gaffney's pub in Lewisburg. He pulls me the pluperfect pint as I, at the end of the bar next the charity boxes, expire on my stool, head in hand, without a murmur. I have just helped him to solve his crossword puzzle, and we commune with ancestral photos in the alcove. He doesn't notice that I am dead until closing time, and he sweeps around my feet. But it's Charlie Gaffney who has died. Charlie, how do I buy a fishing license? Shall I let the dog out? Would the fire take another sod? The pub might as well be empty forever now. I launch the toy lifeboat at my elbow with an old penny. And another Lewisburg, before coming onto the stage, I've had a couple of requests. Very touching to know that anyone knows anything one's written, so I mean, I immediately, obediently oblige. And this, when I'll probably kick the bucket in Belfast, I suppose, but I have this plan that the mourners, I'm thinking of a minibus. I don't expect there to be that many. But they wend their way all the way to Lewisburg and have a few pints there. And this is about the detour of my funeral in Lewisburg. Detour. I want my funeral to include this detour down the single street of a small market town. On either side of the procession, such names as Philbin, O'Malley, McNamara, Keane. A reverent pause to let a herd of milkers pass will bring me face to face with grubby parsnips, cauliflowers that glitter after a sun shower, then hay rakes, broom handles, gas cylinders. Reflected in the slow sequence of shop windows, I shall be part of the action when his wife, draining the potatoes into a steamy sink, calls to the butcher to get ready for dinner, and the publican descends to change a barrel. From behind the one locked door for miles around, I shall prolong a detailed conversation with the man in the concrete telephone kiosk about where my funeral might be going next. That's probably dated. I mean, are there still telephone, concrete telephone kiosks? Are there? Iggy, are there? No. Nobody. I used to queue up in the rain to get into that kiosk. Now everybody has their. And when I was exploring the Iliad, which I do think is our greatest poem, the more I think about it, and there's this wonderful moment in the Iliad where the campfires are compared to the stars in the sky, and it reminded me so much of the clear skies. We don't have light pollution there. You can look into the depths of the Milky Way, and that when I translated it, I Hibernicized it, and I put in bits of County Mayo, Tonakira, Alaran, and Killary, of course. So this is partly the West and partly Homer, the campfires. All night, crackling campfires boosted their morale as they dozed in no man's land and the killing fields. There are balmy nights, not a breath, constellations resplendent in the sky around a dazzling moon. When a clearance high in the atmosphere unveils the boundlessness of space, and all the stars are out, lighting up hilltops, glens, headlands, vantage points like Tonakira and Alaran, where the tide turns into Killary, where salmon run from the sea, where the shepherd smiles on his luminous townland. That many campfires sparkled in front of Ilium, between the river and the ships, 1,000 fires, round each one 50 men relaxing in the firelight, shuffling next to the chariots, munching shiny oats and barley, their horses waited for the sunrise. Now, the other request, do you want to hear what the other request was? It was for a poem called Ceasefire, which, you know, it's a bit like Rachmaninoff with his Prelude in C. Everywhere he went, people wanted him to play it. And this is about the one poem I've written that is, well, it's the best poem. It's not the best poem. It's the best known poem I've written. So I'll read it. And Katrine has already described the scene. And here it is. Put in mind of his own father and moved to tears, Achilles took him by the hand and pushed the old king gently away. But Priam curled up at his feet and wept with him until their sadness filled the building. Taking Hector's corpse into his own hands, Achilles made sure it was washed and, for the old king's sake, laid out in uniform, ready for Priam to carry, wrapped like a present, home to Troy at daybreak. When they'd eaten together, it pleased them both to stare at each other's beauty as lovers might. Achilles, built like a god, Priam, good-looking still and full of conversation, who earlier had sighed, "I get down on my knees and do what must be done, and kiss Achilles' hand, the killer of my son." Now, that's terrific. I have one of them too. When I was writing that, I pictured Priam as Gordon Wilson. You remember the draper from Enniskillen, the devout Methodist who said that he forgave the murderers of his daughter. And I thought for a long time that he was premature, that very few people were able to follow him. But I was at a very good conversation about a week ago with one of our great men, Maurice Hayes. And he said that he thought Gordon Wilson really kept us from civil war, that it was a crucial intervention. Now, I've been obsessed for many years with war, but especially the great, what we call, we still call the Great War. And I want to read from my last volume just two short oblique poems that still interest me. I haven't quite worked out where these poems came from. You never really work out where poems come from, but this one is called Pipistrelle, and it's about a soldier who lost his skin, probably in a mustard gas attack, and nurses looked after him very lovingly in a solution of warm, salty water. And I give him a pet, a strange, surreal pet, a little bat that visits him in the evening. And then Katrina handed me a card. You don't get this sort of message very often. It says, Anaximenes. Isn't that terrific? Yeah. So for whoever wrote Anaximenes, I'll mention him in the second poem, which is called Harmonica, and which at the moment is the poem of mine I like the best, or dislike the least, which is a pity because it's only 7 lines long. But it was my dad, when I brought home a mouth organ. It still moves me to think of it. He just picked it up and he played it, and he hadn't played it really a mouth organ since 1918, but like a lot of the soldiers, he taught himself the mouth organ. And I wanted to write about it, but I couldn't write about it until I was reading a book on early Greek philosophy, and there was Anaximenes, who believed that air was the basis of all life. Pipistrelle. They kept him alive for years in warm water, the soldier who had lost his skin. At night, he was visited by the wounded bat he had unfrozen after Passchendaele, locking its heels under his forefinger and whispering into the mousy fur. Before letting the pipistrelle flicker above his summery pool and tipple there, he spread the wing hand, elbow to thumb. The membrane felt like a poppy petal. Harmonica. I should say a music hall favorite. You can choose whichever one you like, but the one that I have in the back of my mind is It's a Long Way to Tipperary. And I fell in love with the songs of the First World War when Seamus and Mary Heaney came back from their honeymoon in London with a record of Oh, What a Lovely War by the Joan Littlewood production with all the marvellous songs. And I never gave it back to them. Well, remember it? Harmonica. A Tommy drops his harmonica in no man's land. My dad, like old Anaximenes, breathes in and out through the holes and reeds and finds this melody. Our souls are air. They hold us together. Listen. A music hall favorite lasts until the end of time. My dad is playing it. His breath contains the world. The wind is playing an orchestra of harmonicas. Most of the students I'm seeing, the postgraduate students I'm seeing in Trinity, are trying to write prose. So I look at their prose, and one of the things that has interested me for a long time is the crossover, the overlap between poetry and prose. It seems to me that there's more poetry in a few paragraphs of John Banville or Sebastian Barry than in a lot of slim volumes. And that poetry and good poetry and good prose share and have in common rhythmic vitality. And the next poem is a kind of found poem. I'd been spending a small fortune on military histories and maps and so forth, and following my father from 1914 to 1918 through the hellholes of northern France. And but I couldn't track down his citation. And somebody gave me a tip. They gave me an address on the net. And I sent off, eventually, a stamped addressed envelope and a check for £4.50, best £4.50 ever spent, and got his citation for his military cross. And I was overwhelmed by how brave he was. And then I realized, looking at it, that it broke itself up into basically 10 syllable lines. So I broke it up, and then I added 3 lines of my own at the beginning and 2 lines of my own at the end to get a kind of unrhymed sonnet. You'd no idea there was so much trickery involved, did you? And I used this extraordinary word at the end of the poem, firestep, which is the ridge about shin height, the shelf upon which soldiers would step to take pot shots or to go over the top. Anyway, this was for my father. You know, I'm still getting over. I've really never got used to the idea that he died when I was so young. Citation. It is like a poem. It is better than a poem, the citation for my father's military cross, dividing itself up into lines like this, for conspicuous gallantry and devotion to duty, in leading the waves of his company in a raid, and being the first to enter both objectives in spite of a severe shrapnel wound in the thigh. After killing several of the enemy himself, he directed the fire of his Lewis gunners and rifle bombers onto a working party of over 100 of the enemy and controlled the mopping up of the enemy dugouts. Kept alive by his war cry and momentum, I shiver behind him on the far step. I'd have given him the Victoria Cross. So I'll round off with 3 or 4 new poems. I was on the Shetlands last March visiting my daughter, who was doing some painting there. And this is a poem about the Shetlands. Mentions, this place names are like nowhere else. Toft, where you get the ferry to Yell. Lovely names. And I also, you know, when an otter turns in the tide, it looks like kelp flashing. Anyway, Kieran Carson told me before I came in to just short introductions. He said, no long introductions, thank you. That's all, as always, I do what I'm told. On the Shetlands. On the Shetlands, we don't know anyone. So we gossip about the animals, or we contact home on the mobile. As we wait at Toft for the Yell ferry, you walk up and down the little beach, too deep in conversation and sad news to notice an otter's kelp flashes. Look, I'm trying not to frighten him away. You climb alone to where witches burned and disturb a white hare. Albino or snowy-coated still? I have no idea. Shy, behind his streaming forelock, he approaches us, one disheveled pony, a grandchild's mount. Shall I comb his mane? His hoof prints fill with rain and inspire me, my hobbling, diminutive Pegasus. And when I went to Shetland, I swore that I wouldn't write a poem about a Shetland pony. And I've just gone and done it. And a poem about my grandson coming to Carrigskeewaun when he was a babe in arms, and it was so wet that he and his parents had to take a lift from Paddy Morrison, a neighbour, in his tractor. And I'll read this poem. Deliver it for my grandson, Ben. Yes, this extraordinary experience of being a grandparent. This is your first night in Carrigskeewaun. The Owen Adronon is so full of rain. You arrived in Paddy Morrison's tractor, a bumpy approach in your father's arms, to the cottage where, all of 1 year ago, you were conceived, a fire seed in the hearth. Did you hear the wind in the fluffy chimney? Do you hear the wind tonight, and the rain, and a shorebird calling from the mussel reefs? Tomorrow, I'll introduce you to the sea, little hoplite. Have you been missing it? I'll park your chariot by the otter's rock and carry you over seaweed to the sea. There's a tufted duck on David's Lake with her suit full of hatchlings, pom-poms a day old and already learning to dive. We may meet the stoat near the erratic boulder, a shrew in his mouth, or the merlin meadow pipit hunting. But don't be afraid. The leveret breakfasts under the fuchsia every morning, and we shall be watching. I have picked wild flowers for you, scabious and centaury, in a jam jar of water that will bend and magnify the daylight. This is your first night in Carrigskeewaun. And then there were three more grandsons, and each one had to have a poem. And I said that if the fifth, when it came along, wasn't a girl, I was going on grandfatherly strike. The fifth one is a beautiful girl called Catherine. And last summer in Carrigskeewaun, there was this very strange thing, and nobody's explained it to me. About 100 sheep stood around the cottage as though hypnotized. It was very, very strange. And I wrote this little poem for Catherine. Fold can be used as a transitive verb. The fold. Why would the ewes and their lambs assemble as though hypnotized around the cottage? Do they sense a storm on its way, or a fox? Darkness and quiet are folding all the sheep of Carrigskeewaun, their fleeces lustrous, long wool for a baby's comfort blanket, for Catherine asleep in her crib this midnight, our lambing time. And I'll close with my most recent poem, written for a dear friend called Raymond Piper, who's famous he was obsessed with the wild orchids of Ireland, and he painted them all. And I went on trips with him, and it was one of the richest things in my life. And Paddy Kieran Carson, I'll just introduce this because I'm not too. It's four 11-line stanzas, and it mentions Christopher Smart, you know, his Jubilati Agno. And Christopher Smart said, I love his section of that on flowers. He says, for flowers are peculiarly the poetry of Christ. And I quoted that when I spoke at Raymond's funeral. And I quote a line from Smart later in the poem, for flowers are good both for the living and the dead. And there's a kind of joke in the, it's full of jokes, but I do explain them a little bit because nobody laughs at my jokes at readings. So I'm giving you a cue. And this one, the iconic flowers of the burren are the gentian and the avon, winter avons and cranesbill, red, white, and blue. And our Ulster joke was that they're the colours of the Union Jack. I'd agree, it's not a very good joke. And then, oh yes, we went on the shores of Loch Bunny. We wanted to photograph the dropwort, which is quite a rare flower. And it was a gale was blowing. So we took turns standing like this with our raincoats, sheltering it for the other to photograph. And from the road, we must have looked like a couple of aging flashers. And Raymond had a dilapidated greenhouse at the back of his home, and in it grew a mimosa tree. And then the poor men's, with recalling a trip we made in a little smack, fishing smack, we had hired called Mystical Rose to go out to the Salties to look for insular hybrids. And I think that's all I need to say. But thank you for coming. And it matters to me reading here. And I haven't read this before, so I'm a bit shaky. It's a slightly jazzy poem. Shall I give it a go? And thank you. Cloud Orchid, in memory of Raymond Piper. Ours was a language of flowers, as Christopher Smart would have it. An antrum meadow, unimproved, covered in lady's smock and ragged robin. Pink pyramids at Killard. The colours of the Union flag in the Republic, gentian, avons, cranesbill, our Ulster joke. Spring gentian's ultimate blue, the secret of the cosmos, close to the ground among the grasses. You are standing and pointing first at the cheeky Sheila na Gig, then at her offspring, unexpected bee orchids around her doorway in Kilnaboy. Near Loch Bunny, like an antique flasher in the wind, spreading your overcoat to screen a frantic dropwort. After our solitary fly orchid, conjuring on a bridge for me, clouds of orange-tipped butterflies. Undistracted in your greenhouse studio by caterpillar droppings from the mimosa tree that twisted overhead, you gazed up through the branches and the broken pane, imagining your last flower portrait, for flowers are good both for the living and the dead. The minuscule cloud orchid that grows in the rainforest's misty canopy. The rusty fuse you brought home from a specific hummock in Corrigskeewaun, autumn ladies' tresses, yet to flower under your greenhouse's moony glass in Belfast. Do you want me to move it from the sill onto the ground for moisture, or repot it, or hire, as once we did, Mystical Rose, and chug out to the Salties?
Thank you very much, Michael, for a wonderful reading this evening. Michael has very kindly agreed to take a couple of questions at the end before we finish.
Go on, somebody. Seamus?
I think it's very
good. What?
I think you created a silence which is
perfect. Yeah.
Well, I think that perhaps does say it. Thank you again, Michael.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight.